There's a number of bills up there.
Okay.
Are we ready?
Brings out a lot of people.
Okay.
Yeah. Certainly worked a lot on it.
Have a quorum.
You're probably. Yeah, Pepito's coming up.
We'll call the Senate Health and Human Services Finance Division to order for Tuesday, March 10th. We have 4 bills on the agenda for today. We're going to start with Senate File 3. Senator Clausen, welcome to the committee.
Well, good morning, Chair Laurie and committee members, and thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 3, a health care loan forgiveness proposal. As many of you know, health care is the fastest growing industry in Minnesota. However, our state is not keeping pace with industry workforce needs. And this is especially true in rural and underserved communities. And to address this concern, Senate File 3 provides targeted loan forgiveness to health care professionals who agree to practice in rural and underserved communities. And this initiative is the result of two legislative actions. The first, in 2014, the legislature authorized a 2-year health care workforce commission to identify current and anticipated health care workforce shortages and evaluate the effectiveness of incentives to retain a highly skilled workforce. The commission met through the summer and fall of 2014 to develop preliminary considerations and recommendations for the 2015 legislative session. And at this time, I'd like to recognize the commitment and contributions of committee members who served on the Health Care Commission that are with us today, Senator Benson, who serves on your committee, and also Senator Laurie. Thank you so much for your commitment. In 2013, the legislature agreed to study mental health workforce needs. Over 30 mental health professionals met for 18 months. They conducted 20 community forums and outreach meetings throughout the state, surveyed over 500 residents, and held a mental health summit attended by over 150 professionals in May of 2014. Among their recommendations, both study groups supported expansion of the existing health professional loan forgiveness program to meet the needs of rural Minnesota and underserved communities. This expansion includes an increased funding allocation and the addition of mental health professionals, public health nurses, and dental therapists to the state loan forgiveness program. At this time, I'd like to call upon Mark Schoenbaum, Director of Rural Health and Primary Care for the Minnesota Department of Health. Mr. Schoenbaum will identify the healthcare professional shortages in our state and outline the Minnesota loan forgiveness program.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Schoenbaum. Senator Clausen, I was privileged, as you mentioned, to serve on the healthcare workforce task force. The only thing that I had concerns about was the 5-hour hearings that we held all through the interim. That was a little rough, I'm going to be honest. But we got some good recommendations out of it, and I'm glad to have them here. Mr. Schoenbaum, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. Good morning, members. I think you're probably blaming me for the 5-hour meeting.
I am. So we'll keep it a little bit brief, more brief
we'll
today.
Brief this morning. And I'm here today in two roles, the role as staff to the Legislative Healthcare Workforce Commission. The Health Department was very pleased to be given that assignment, and it was a great experience, even if some of the meetings were long. And also as manager of the Loan Forgiveness Program at the Health Department. You'll see both, I think, in your packets and on the screen now, a series of maps. The Workforce Commission analyzed workforce needs and their variation through the state. I think committees this session have seen, starting to see a lot of these maps. So I won't dive into the details. I think they just make the point that there are shortages in the occupations addressed by the bill: primary care, mental health, dentistry, in various areas throughout the state, both in rural Minnesota and in the urban core in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And loan forgiveness is a tool that is designed to direct new graduates, to those shortage areas as they begin their careers. The loan forgiveness program has been around for some time, and the health department has contracted for several outside objective evaluations of the program, and we track participants in the program over time. Both the data and those outside evaluations document that loan forgiveness in Minnesota is a strategy that not only works to initially recruit professionals to where they are most needed, but it also has a strong retention effect, and that participants in the program remain in those high need areas for 5, 10, sometimes 20 years later, and often make their careers in those rural and inner city areas. So that first job experience really can have a lasting impact on someone's work history. You've got a handout in your folder, loan forgiveness program evaluation. The first page of the handout shows some of the background and the budget history of the program. If you turn it over to the page with a page of tables, you'll see the professions that are currently eligible to receive loan forgiveness and the conditions in which they must serve to get those incentive payments. And then you'll see over time, from 5 years to over 20 years, the retention data that we have on the loan forgiveness program.
Mr. Chair and Committee, I went through those slides showing the shortage areas in the state rather quickly, but you do have those, and you can see why we chose to go with the mental health professions, the public nurses, and then the dental therapists, because it shows those shortage areas both in the urban and outstate Minnesota areas. The next slide really is a summary of what the bill does. There are three main provisions to Senate File 3. It increases funding for Minnesota loan forgiveness programs. It targets loan forgiveness funds to rural and underserved communities, providing an additional 200 health care providers over 4 years to needy communities. And lastly, it adds mental health professionals, public health nurses, and dental therapists to the loan forgiveness program. This next slide shows examples of the Minnesota Loan Forgiveness Program, how the effect on student debt for selected professions. The chart includes the three professions Senate File 3 proposes to add to the Loan Forgiveness Program: the public health nurses, mental health professionals, dental therapists. The forgiveness amount after 4 years is right around 60% of the total loan amount. And you can see, again, from that chart, what this program would do. Last slide we have is an article from the Minnesota Daily. It was interesting. The day that we first introduced Senate File 3, I received a call from one of the local news outlets, and they wanted to do a story on it. By the time I got back to them, however, it was a bad snow day in Minnesota, and that took precedent over this. But they had already shared with me they'd been over at the University of Minnesota at the medical school and dental school and were stopping students in the hallway talking about this plan. And as you can see, it was a good idea. Even the Minnesota Daily agrees. We do have two additional testifiers, Dr. Kathleen Mackin. She's the residency director at United Family Medicine, and that's located right on West 7th Street, only a few miles from our Capitol, and Dr. Mackin will provide testimony.
Welcome, Dr. Mackin. State your name for the record and present
Kathleen
your testimony.
Kathleen Mackin. Thank you, Mr. Chairperson, committee members, and everyone who's here for this very important issue. United Family Medicine. I am a family doc. I have been a family doc post-residency for 35 years. I've had the privilege and incredible opportunity to work in urban underserved my whole career and to intentionally train people in urban underserved for greater Minnesota. You may question, why does that work? It works because of the similarities in urban underserved and rural underserved and the robustness or size of population served, which therefore gives our residents really rich experiences in things like pediatrics and women's health that perhaps, at least in our experience, really prepares them for rural health care delivery. We have 120 graduates this year. We're a 23-year-old program. Approximately 40% of our graduates work rural. I will speak to the fact that they have significant fiscal burden. Most of them come from quite regular average middle-class families, often from small towns. They're going back to those small towns. And to have an opportunity and to be supported with loan forgiveness has really, you know, anecdotally in our experience, not representing the numbers that Mark has shown us, but has in fact shown exactly what the Minnesota Department of Health says, is that these people stay in these small communities and are able, therefore, to, I think, do a fantastic job and not be so incredibly burdened with the fiscal part that they couldn't choose to do that work. I will tell you, primary care family medicine is probably the best job you could ever get in your life. Truly, truly, truly. It also is very much a service-oriented job. And people, yes, it's a phenomenal reimbursement. My father was a postal clerk, had 8 kids. I mean, hello. Needless to say, I've had a much different experience with finances. And it's very much a service-oriented position. And to support people in this decision to go to greater Minnesota, well prepared to serve a community, is, I think, meets the needs of greater Minnesota in the state. And I will add, we're totally training in an interdisciplinary collaborative fashion, and the critical nature of public health, mental health, adequate nursing and nursing homes, dental work is critical to the health of those communities as well. So we feel very fortunate, privileged to have the opportunity to train people to do this. Many of our other grads stay urban underserved, but clearly it really, really makes it possible for people to do this and to maintain some balance so that we can sustain them over a very long career, as contrasted to, say, burning out or feeling that fiscally they can't sustain it and have to make a different decision and leave that area and go back and do something else. So it's a true privilege to talk with all of you, and I may or may not have answered all the things you would like to know, but I would say it's such a thoughtful bill, and so much work has gone into it to look at the whole multidisciplinary team, which is critical to communities and populations' well-being.
Well, Dr. Mackin, your passion for training the next generation of primary care and mental health workforce comes through clearly, and thank you for that. It's an incredibly important role, and one that's difficult to find people to serve in. I mean, not everybody is so encouraging about going into the primary care arena, and we certainly need to pitch that as a wonderful practice area and a wonderful life, if that's what you're looking to do. Senator Rosen?
Thank you. And Dr. Mackin, I appreciate your comments. I found several things that you mentioned intriguing, that you talked about the similarity between rural underserved and urban underserved, and that is so very true. And when Senator Berglund was chair of this committee, I took a field trip into her district because of the similarities that I found with her district and my district, which is very deep rural also. And so we had a lot in common, so thank you for addressing that. I think that's important. The other thing that you mentioned that I found was very intriguing is the importance of the primary doctor and that relationship of that doctor out in rural greater Minnesota, basically. And that is really the kind of relationship that many people want to have, is a one-on-one with a doctor. And that's why it's so important to be able to have doctors to stay in the community, also telemedicine, so you can still mm-hmm. have that one-on-one mm-hmm. relationship with your doctor, but also have the ability to get specialized care someplace else. And the other thing I was going to mention, Senator Claussen, that visiting with some of my dentists in my district that are really struggling with just access. I mean, there's just not enough dentists out there, as you know. This loan forgiveness program is probably one of the biggest tools, they say, out there. And it's really important. Doesn't guarantee that these dentists are going to take on any public program patients, but it is bringing them out there because it is so critical with their debt, which is the highest of all the professions that you've listed. But it's this loan forgiveness is really a big deal, and I hope you know that, and which I'm sure you do. But.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Claussen,
I had an opportunity to visit Dr. Mackin's clinic, and how they use their time over lunch is they sat around a table, and one of the residents was presenting a case and getting feedback from all the other resident doctors. It was just really impressive to have that opportunity. So if any of you would like to visit Dr. Mackin's clinic, she'd be very open to it, and it's a good eye-opener.
Yeah, and I'll only mention, Mr. Chair and committee, that the clinic we work in is a federal qualified health center. So I think it is, if people have a desire to know more about that or feel like they would like to know more, it's a I think an effective methodology approach to population-based health across disciplines again, because we do have dental and mental health and do as many procedural things as we can possibly do in our clinic because of our under and uninsured patients. There's great complexity, but I think true to, again, to state, our graduates who are in small towns say, oh, the mental health issues here, the chemical dependency issues here, the chronic pain issues here, the need to be able to help babies be born close to home are every bit as significant in those small communities as they are in the urban underserved areas too.
Okay. And Senator Claussen, did you have one more testifier?
We do, yes. Sue Apterholden, Executive Director of NAMI. And while Sue is up, you have a number of handouts that we provided. There's also a fiscal note that you have. In addition, there have been letters of support that you should have from the Minnesota Rural Health Association, Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs, and Minnesota Medical Association.
Excellent. Ms. Apterholden, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Sue Abdercolin, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. Back in 2013, you might remember that you directed MNSCU to develop a comprehensive plan to increase the number of people working at all levels of our mental health system, to ensure appropriate coursework and training, and to create a more culturally diverse workforce. And, of course, the reason for this is that we have 9 out of our 11 regions of the state that are designated as mental health workforce shortage areas. And I want to mention that it's not just psychiatrists, although that is a huge problem, but it's all mental health professionals. We actually have counties in our state that do not have licensed clinical social workers or psychologists, nurse practitioners who specialize in mental health, and there's also shortages of marriage and family therapists and professional clinical counselors. You should have received the really quite wonderful report. I've served on a lot of task forces, but this one was really quite excellent, and the report was great. And in there, one of the main recommendations is actually to expand the loan forgiveness program to mental health professionals in rural areas and to culturally diverse communities. We believe that this bill is a great start in making progress in that area. One thing I do want to point out is that if you do expand funding for mental health services, which, of course, we just know you will, we need more workers in the field. Even if we wanted to expand school-linked mental health services by 100% again, we would not have enough people to actually carry that out. So it's very important that when we look at really creating a more robust mental health system, that we look at our workforce shortages as well. And just want to say that we really appreciate Senator Claussen's leadership on this area and very much support this bill.
Excellent. Senator Claussen, did you have additional testimony?
Yes, we do, Mr. Chair.
opposed to that.
And just for your information, this is the first of two workforce bills, so you will be hearing a second bill, I think, next week.
I think that's correct. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Dr. Rick Lee. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Floor Bill 3. I know I wasn't on the agenda, but I appreciate the opportunity. I did travel in this morning from Wilmer so that I could testify before the committee. I come before the committee now in two capacities. First, I'm a 21-year employee as a licensed psychologist and currently the CEO of Woodland Centers, which is a community mental health center with its main office in Candiota County and offices in five other rural counties, Chippewa, Lac du Parle, Meeker, Renville, and Swift, all of which, as you saw in the slides, are federally designated rural shortage areas. Secondly, I'm the past president of the board of the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs, which represents community mental health providers across the state. I want to emphatically support the addition of mental health professionals to the Minnesota Health Professional Education Loan Forgiveness Program. As you know from the mental health workforce report, which I did have the opportunity to participate both in a community meeting in Wilmer and the summit in Maple Grove last year, there is a general shortage of mental health professionals in Minnesota, and the shortage in rural Minnesota is especially acute. Community mental health providers represent a significant part of the safety net for some of the most vulnerable citizens of our communities. And in some rural areas, we're the only mental health provider in the entire county. And in all the counties in which Woodland Centers operates, we are the largest provider of mental health services. Woodland Centers is recognized by the National Health Service Corps, the federal loan repayment program. But that program has limitations that sometimes don't meet the needs of our communities. A key limitation is that the National Health Service Corps requires a participant to work at a specified site, a place. This requirement stands in opposition to the increasingly prevalent expectation that mental health providers work with people in community settings, as well as the highly desirable and successful model, which has been emphatically supported by this legislature, to bring mental health services to children and their families in school settings. Right now, I have two school-based mental health professionals who want to move from those positions into traditional outpatient counseling positions so that they can be eligible to apply for the National Health Service Corps Loan Forgiveness Program. If I accept that request, I lose two providers in that key program. If I don't accept their request, I potentially have two disgruntled employees who are not eligible for tens of thousands of dollars of student loan relief. Senate Floor 3 could help to address this gap. I grew up in suburban Minneapolis. When my wife, who is also a suburban-bred mental health professional, and I moved to Wilmer 21 years ago, we never imagined we would stay so long. We have found living and practicing in a rural area to be personally and professionally rewarding, and our experience is not unique. Woodland Centers has many examples of professionals who came for what they thought might just be a few years, but have stayed to work and raise their families. We believe if we can get young professionals in the door, we have a good shot at making it very hard for them to leave. Senate Floor 3 can be another tool to help us recruit mental health professionals. It's my job to help them to want to stay. Woodland Centers and the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs strongly support this bill and what it can do to bring crucial mental health capacity to rural communities. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Clausen, for bringing this important issue forward.
Thank you, Dr. Lee, for driving in from Wilmer. I'm glad we were able to fit you in. Any questions of members?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Dr. Lee. That was very good. I think you very well stated, especially about the mental health in greater Minnesota. We're at an acute level here, especially with the children. And all the work that we're doing on child protection, we don't have the resources to take care of our children. Thank you very much. I thought that was very good.
Thank you, Senator.
Is there any other questions from committee? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to offer additional testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File Number 3? Seeing none, Senator Rosen moves Senate File 3 be recommended to pass and laid on the table for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Finance Bill. On that motion, any further questions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevailed. Thank you, Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Senator and committee members.
Next, we have Senator Hayden, Senate File 734. Oh, now that's just cruel. Now, Senator Hayden, who
Good
does
morning.
This?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I see you have my hand out, and Mr. Chair, I will say you were a dashing young man in 1986.
I'm sorry.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I have Senate File 734, which is the increasing the TANF monthly allocation bill. I don't know if that's our official title. That's what I'm saying it today. As we've heard over the years from our friends from the Welfare Rights Coalition, from families, from advocates, the cash assistance grant for the MFIB program has not increased since 1986. To put that in some perspective, I think, Mr. Chair, we saw a handout and we've seen some of us what we looked like in 1986, as well as I was 2 years out of high school and was just enlisting in the Air Force as a medical technician. I think we can all agree a lot has changed since then. And while the cash grants have not increased, the cost of living has certainly have. Today's bill increases the cash grant to families enrolled in MFIB by $100. A $100 boost will go a long ways in helping family meet their basic needs. For example, one of the biggest barriers to employment is transportation. This increase will help families across the state close the transportation gap so that they can get to work, get to school, and get back on their feet. Mr. Chair and members, there is bipartisan support to increase the cash grant using TANF funds currently diverted to the Working Family Credit and the Minnesota Department of Health. With me to discuss the bill further, I have Jessica Webster, co-chair of the Prosperity for All campaign, and Caitlin Magistad with the Wilder Foundation.
All right. Ms. Webster, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jessica Webster. As Senator Hayden stated, I'm the co-chair of the Prosperity for All campaign and coalition. That's more than 70 statewide organizations who are representing and committed to the voices of striving parents and their children in the Minnesota Family Investment Program. I'm also a member of the TANF Expenditures Task Force, which I'll describe a little bit in detail today, too. Today, Senator Lori and members, is also Day on the Hill for the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition, and some of those members will be here today. There'll be a lot of buzz about this bill, so thank you very much for hearing this bill today. As Senator Hayden said, this is not the first time you've heard this session about the MFIP cash grant. It's $532 for a family of three. It has not increased since 1986. It's 29 years flat. One of the new things that we wanted to do today, rather than show the epic stylings of Senator Lori's hair, was just to talk about, to bring some more voices to this discussion. So in the packet, what you'll see is you'll see letters of organizational support from around the state. Another thing we did is we collected hundreds of stories from MFIP participants around the state about what would $100 mean to your family. And some of those things are car insurance, gasoline for young parents trying to get to work, it's school uniforms for their children, it's baby Tylenol, simple over-the-counter medications that are not covered by health insurance, it's rent, it's utilities, it's past due bills, it's nothing earth-shattering, and it's not going to solve, all of a sudden, you know, magically solve all of a family's expenses, but it meets critical needs, and $100 would be just a fantastic start on working to address the erosion of this grant. I think the big question is why now? Why this year? And one of the reasons that we see an urgency to this is that it's no longer just advocates and families coming to the legislature about this. The legislatively created TANF task force, which had legislators, advocates, counties, local public health professionals, recently studied this issue, looked at the grant erosion, and really wrestled with what do you do when a grant has eroded this far? And I think that that group, at a minimum, they saw that what needed to be done is that TANF needed to be clawed back from where it has left the TANF fund and gone outside of Health and Human Services to the Working Family Credit and the Department of Health, with those programs being backfilled with general fund. And so by bringing those dollars, about $70 million in TANF, back to the fund, that is a way that you could do this and increase the cash grant. The task force said by about $80. Some think that maybe it's closer to $100 with the recent caseload declines, so that's where the money would come from. There's no opposition to clawing those dollars back from Working Family Credit and from the Department of Health, as long as those funds are backfilled with general fund and those programs, which are very critical, do not face a cut. So, Mr. Chair and members, it's just time. It's time to do this. It's 29 years. We can keep coming to the legislature to ask for this, but it really is time to address this so it's not eroded further. We sincerely appreciate your consideration.
Maybe we can hear from the two testifiers you brought forward and then ask questions, or if you need it. Okay. Ms. Magistad, is that correct?
Yes.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Caitlin Magistad. I'm a supportive housing case manager with the Wilder Foundation, and I previously worked as an MFIP employment counselor in Ramsey County. I'm here today because I believe that Minnesota can do better for the 70,000 children enrolled in MFIP, the families that I work with every day. In my current experience, MFIP grants are not high enough to meet basic needs. Families are trapped in constant chronic stress. Families are merely trying to survive. The families I've worked with want to be able to support themselves independently. However, some parents face different challenges on their path to success. Some common barriers include limited job training and education opportunities, physical and mental health concerns, family violence, and other trauma. However, I'm not here to talk about the brokenness of poor families. MFIP parents are just like any other parents. They want the same things for their children, for their children to be happy and healthy, to do well in school, and to be prepared for life. I recently asked the parents who I work with, how would $100 help your family? The responses that I received were simple, but they speak volumes. Transportation expenses, laundry, school uniforms and school supplies, shoes, socks, and underwear, work uniforms, cleaning and hygiene supplies. My clients and I work together to create monthly budgets to meet their household's needs, but find that monthly assistance is not enough to pay rent, transportation, and utility costs. A family of three receives a maximum of $532 per month. Think about having to choose between attending your child's school conference or having enough gas or bus fare to get to work the next day. Think about having to enroll your child in after-school activities or pay your phone bill. These may sound small to us as adults, but these are momentous and important occasions for children. The parents I work with all want to do more for their kids, whether it's enriching activities or being able to offer a special reward for doing well in school. At the very least, they don't want their children to internalize financial stress and worry. An MFIP increase is an opportunity to support families in moving forward so that they can create new possibilities for themselves and their children. I respectfully request your support for Senate File 734. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Magistad. Senator Brown, you had a question?
Oh, yes, and this is for any of the testifiers, but thank you, Mr. Chair. You've given quite a laundry list of what $100 a month could do. How did we come to the $100? I'm wondering why not $200? I'm trying to read this fiscal note, but what is the total cost? The second question would be, what is the total cost of this, and why just $100?
Ms. Webster?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, so I haven't seen today's fiscal note. The way that the TANF task force came to $80, we thought it was between $80 and $100. The full fiscal analysis wasn't available, but it was clawing back the TANF that is currently in the working family credit and the TANF that is going to the Minnesota Department of Health, and bringing those TANF funds back into the TANF program so that those funds could be used to provide assistance to families. There's not currently, bringing those funds back, there would not be enough TANF to increase the grant $200. I think it would be fantastic if this committee wanted to raise the grant $200 and use additional general fund to do that.
So, Senator Brown, in the fiscal note, what you'll see is the bill says that we're going to appropriate some amount from the TANF fund. Well, there is no balance in the TANF fund right now, so we're actually kind of reliant on maybe the tax committee has a bill to pick up the working family tax credit on the tax rolls and do that with general fund and tax credits and free up that TANF fund, and then this bill could work. So they have to kind of work in tandem. We'd have to pick up with the general fund the Department of Health expenditures. I don't think that we would intend, nor did the task force recommend, that we actually cut those TANF expenditures and do this instead. So this is a proposal that's in tandem with a couple of other proposals moving through the legislature. We have to free up those TANF funds that are used for the working family credit and the Department of Health, and now we have the fiscal analysis about how much that is, and it yields about $100 per month. Okay.
And thank you for that explanation, yeah. Mr. Chair. But I know this is one of the challenges this committee faces, but sometimes I think we need to, if we're going to do something, we should do it right. I'm not convinced that $100 a month is going to truly be a huge help as much as if we could double that. And again, I know that's a challenge we face, but one of the things, and I know, Mr. Chair, you look at this, but let's do some of the things right the first time so that people don't have to keep coming back and coming back instead of trying to do many things a little bit. So that's just my offering on that.
Yep.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, I just want to comment.
Senator Hayden.
I think you're right. I mean, I'd love to be able to do more. I think we were, as the chair said, we're trying to balance it with the needs that we have today. But I'd be more than willing if we were able to find more money to go to $200. I think that the testifiers have really articulated in the need and what people can actually do with the extra dollars, mm-hmm. and that it is an overdue increase in this fund.
Absolutely. Senator Benson, you had a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Hayden, if somebody can help me, what is the full amount of TANF money available in 2 years? Before anything's taken out for Working Family Credit, Department of Health, what's the full dollar amount?
Oh, the TANF grant?
Which isn't a TANF.
We can follow up on that. We looked at that in the task force, but I don't have the number at the top of my head.
If possible, Mr. Chair and Senator Hayden, you know, as we continue to work on this, it sounds like it's going to be part of some final solution. I'd like to see a full reconciliation for the biennium, what comes in, where it currently goes, and then we can figure out how this fits. I mean, maybe the working family credit doesn't need to be as big as it is. We have a lot of policy questions to answer, but I don't see any clear communication of how much is actually available. We talk about sliding things from place to place, and I was not on the task force, and I would appreciate the information. Thank you.
Senator Benson, we did have, and I will dig out this information, we had a really good spreadsheet and presentation about the total amount of the TANF grant and what it's used for and some of the history, and we can have that distributed. We can dig that out and have that distributed. And distribute the report that came out of the task force as well. I mean, we really, you know, the working family tax credit is incredibly valued by low-income families, and it wasn't the recommendation of the workforce that we cut the value of the working family tax credit in exchange for raising the cash grant. It wasn't a recommendation of the task force that we cut some of the important work done through the Department of Health. I mean, this was, if we can backfill with general fund to support these incredibly important other, you know, I mean, nurse home visiting type things, if we can support those, then, and free up these TANF funds, then it's something that is a really high priority to do. But if we can't support them, it didn't receive the recommendation of the task force. But we will send out the task force report as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I could follow up.
Yeah.
Are the things that TANF dollars are currently used for, are they limited to just the TANF-eligible population, or do we creep outside that population and end up subsidizing other programs with TANF dollars and not meeting those needs of the TANF-eligible family first? To anyone at your direction, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Webster?
Mr. Chair, members, excuse me, those dollars have to be used on families below 200% of poverty. TANF dollars have to be used. One of the concerns of advocates is that the Minnesota Family Investment Program is significantly lower than 200% of poverty. So it's not that those dollars are going to wealthy individuals by any means, but it's not exclusive to the Minnesota Family Investment Program parents. And we see the TANF funds as really the only resource we have for what is the largest workforce development program for young parents in the state. And so that's why those TANF dollars are so important to these MFIT participants.
Any other questions of members for these testifiers or Senator Hayden? We do have a couple of other testifiers who have asked to speak. Maybe we'll invite them up now. Ms. Watlaw Phillips and Ms. Gowboy, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record. And Senator Hayden, we'll have to fill in this blank appropriation before we finish up.
Oh,
don't let us forget to do that. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Sue Watlow Phillips. I'm the executive director of the Metropolitan Interfaith Council on Affordable Housing, MICA, and the president and CEO of Integrated Community Solutions. I'm also a retired psychologist. What I'd like to talk with you about is some of the questions that you were just asking in regards to this bill. And I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate File 734 and for Prosperity for All joining many of us who have been advocating for years on increasing MFIP grants with welfare rights and other groups, too. I think it's key for us as we're moving forward on increasing MFIP, the Minnesota Family Investment Program, is that we really are looking at equity, investing our tax resources wisely, and loving and treating others the way that we'd want to be treated. So I think one of the major issues is to ask people that are being impacted, what do they need? And obviously, as you heard in previous testimony, that there was discussion that, you know, this $100 could help with some things. But is it really enough? And I think as the Welfare Rights Committee has been promoting, as we have from MICA and from my consulting company, is that for us to really begin to make a step in stabilizing our families, we need to double the public assistance grant. You've been handed a yellow page, which I had handed out to you a few weeks ago, about a month ago, when I was testifying on the governor's budget in regards to MFIP grants and the ability for people to afford housing. You can look at that yellow sheet and you can see that there's nowhere in the state that a public assistance grant, an MFIP grant, can afford housing. So what we're talking about is that we are providing public assistance, but not helping people have enough resources to meet their basic needs. Last week here in the metro area, the Metro HRA opened up their Section 8 program. 36,000 people applied for subsidized housing. That was 13,000 families. And so we have a choice to make. We can increase the grant high enough, and we would suggest it's doubling the grant, so that we're not paying $4,000 to $5,000 a month for a family to be in an emergency shelter if they can't afford their housing, or $1,500 to $2,000 a month in supportive housing services and housing costs, plus moving costs, utility reconnects, and children changing schools. So it's not that we don't need shelters and different types of supportive housing programs, But why are we setting up our families when we're trying to get them back into the workforce to not have enough resources to meet their basic needs? So we can avoid this emergency crisis, and we can use some of our TANF dollars that we're currently using under the TANF Emergency Assistance Program to help provide a part of that subsidy. And we would encourage at least a $300-$400 a month grant increase. We would rather see a doubling, but to get people the housing subsidy so that they can be stable and can go to work, their children can go to school, and we can move people on into the workforce center. On Sunday night, we had 163 families on TANF that were in Hennepin County shelters. That means if we were looking at $4,000 to $5,000 over this 1 month, we will spend $652,000 to $815,000 on those families being in emergency shelter for 1 month. It's not a wise investment of our resources. We need to make sure our families are stable. We decided when we did the welfare reform to call our TANF program the Minnesota Family Investment Program. It's an investment to stabilize our families while they're transitioning back to work and to access, or for those that are not able to work, to access disability assistance if they're eligible. What we are currently doing is kind of like when you send your child off to college, you know, and you pay the tuition, but there's not enough money to pay for housing. So you've got all this great education and opportunities and ready for them to get a really good job in the future, but they don't have any housing to live in while they're going to school. So that's basically what we're doing with our families right now, is that we have a lot of great services for families, but we're not providing the resources so they can meet their basic needs to be able to move on and utilize those services so that they can become a part of our workforce again. Homelessness. In conclusion, homelessness is caused by our structural and inequity issues, not just about people's problems. We must invest in equitable opportunities. Affordable housing, rental and home ownership, Senator Hayden and Senator Herr have a bill, Senate File 282, to help with that. Livable incomes, wages, and our public assistance need to be livable for people to afford their housing. Accessible and affordable and culturally appropriate health care, human services, and excellent educational and job training opportunities. And we need to make sure that our civil rights are respected, protected, and enforced. So I strongly encourage you to go beyond what Senator Hayden is proposing here, and let's really move and really solve the issue so that people can meet their basic needs and double the grants. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Watlaw Phillips. Ms. Gauboy? Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Hi, my name's Linda Galboy.
Before you start, we're handing out to members, Senator Benson, the TANF spreadsheets that we pulled out from. Sorry about that. Sure. Ms. Galboy, welcome.
My name's Linda Galboy. I'm with the Welfare Rights Committee, and I do have copies of my testimony along with some charts, that including what the TANF money is being spent on, as well as kind of a further breakdown. I just want to say that Welfare Rights Committee is working on a bill that will double the grants, and we also, however, support this bill. We think they both should pass this year. The grants should be more than doubled to keep up with the cost of living. According to the federal government's Bureau of Labor Statistics Consumer Price Index calculator, the $532 cash grant for a family of three should be $1,134 today. That's an increase of 113% since 1986, the last year that the grants went up. There's a typo in my testimony, sorry. So if we do this bill with the 100% increase and we double the grants, that would get most families to where they ought to be. That is how far behind the state is. We have to do Hayden's bill plus our bill to double the grants to even get to where we should be. I'm going to talk more about funding. I know there's been a lot of compelling testimony about how much people are suffering because of how low these grants are. Some of it is so terrible it can't even be testified upon in front of this committee. If Minnesota used all of the federal TANF money for cash grants, that would provide most of the funding needed for both of these bills. Currently, only 28% of the federal TANF money goes to families in the form of cash grants. We say all the money should be used for cash grants. We also say that the other programs that currently get TANF money should be funded with general fund money. Most of the TANF fund goes to counties in the form of the consolidated fund. It's like a block grant. We can't find figures for county-by-county spending for this money. For example, we know that some counties offer emergency assistance, which is allowed under this fund, and some counties do not. But the first TANF Task Force report gives a statewide breakdown of how this consolidated money is spent, and it's on page, it's the first chart on page 2. Most of it goes to job service costs and administration. We feel that these things should be funded by the general fund, specifically by deed, not by TANF money. This is the year that the state should start doing what it should have been doing all along. Use general fund money for county administration, county bureaucracy, and plumb contracts for county for private nonprofits. Use TANF money for TANF families. And that's just one example. The same can be said for all the programs that are currently funded by TANF. Most are good programs, but they can and should be funded by the general fund. The TANF money that's out there, $264 million a year, won't cover all the costs for funding both these bills. The rest of the funding to pass both these bills should come from the budget surplus this year and be built into the future. After the November forecast came out, we were told that the surplus wasn't really $1 billion because of inflation. If you really wanted to take inflation into account, take into account the full cost of keeping up with inflation for the welfare grants, 113% increase. Again, the cost of living has more than doubled since 1986. With the February forecast coming in at $1.8 billion, I think we can very safely not worry about inflation and say we have a $1 billion surplus. A surplus that was built on the backs of the poor. 29 years without an increase in MFIP or GA. Lots of people in this state who need help cannot get a dime, and yet the state sits on this giant surplus. In conclusion, as you argue for budget targets and as you enter into budget negotiations, we urge you to fully fund both bills. Double the welfare grants, do the $100 increase. The cost of living has more than doubled. 29 years is too long to wait.
Thank you, Ms. Grabway. Any questions of members for these two testifiers? Seeing none, Senator Hayden, any thoughts?
Well, no, Mr. Chair. I think that we've had compelling testimony. We've dealt with this issue over the years. I do think that it hopefully we can work in tandem with the tax committee as well as our targets to look at backfilling the dollars that were going out in the other necessary programs that we help low-income families. But I do think that it is time for us to increase it. I don't disagree with some of my testifiers. I think they've made a compelling case of where we should probably be and where we should go. But I do think that taking the first bite out of this apple, we should at least try to pass Senate File 734 and start moving forward so that we can continue to invest in these families so that they can then at some point be able to not depend on these resources.
And so Senator Hayden moves to insert in the blank appropriation on page 2, line 2, $38,128,000.
Sounds good to me.
On that motion, any questions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. And is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 734? I'm seeing none. Any further questions, Senator Benson?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hayden, if we have to make a choice between Working Family Tax Credit and TANF grants, is there some middle ground that would be workable? Are you working on something like that?
Senator Hayden.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Benson. You know, I don't use this that choice, because I think that it's, someone's told me it's disrespectful. It's a really tough choice to make. I think what I'd really like to do is just to continue to work with the Tax Committee, Senator Scoy, and other members of it, to see how we can work on that issue, and then work with our chair in this committee to see if we can figure out how to kind of put those two together to get this moving forward. So I think it's a little early to kind of get to that point of what choices we have to make. I think that I am really confident, as my phone kind of goes off, I'm really confident that we can kind of put this package together and really get this extra resources to families.
Thank you. Senator Hayden, moved Senate File 734 as amended be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS omnibus bill. On that motion, any further questions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hayden. Next up is Senator Franzen, Senate File 790.
One testifier, Lyndon Gauboy. She's right on. So right on. She comes back.
Senator Franzen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Good morning. Senate File 790 deals with funding the work of the Minnesota Stroke System of Care. For the past 5 years, stakeholders from around the state have designed a comprehensive system to treat acute stroke in Minnesota. Stroke is a time-critical condition. That means that an appropriate treatment needs to happen quickly. The Minnesota Stroke System is a statewide network of ambulance services and acute care hospitals in Minnesota that meet national standards for treatment of acute stroke patients. With these players working together collaboratively and coordinating efforts during every step of an acute medical event, we can speed up the care for patients when minutes count. The Minnesota Stroke System has been designed and implemented so far under a federal grant that may or may not be available from year to year. Senate File 790 before you asked for $350,000 a year to ensure that this important work continues and the basic functions of the system can continue to operate. And just for a bit of context, members, planning for the statewide stroke system began in 2010, and at that point there were less than 20 designated stroke centers around the state. 4 years later, we have 67, and this funding will help support continue that work. With me, I have Justin Bell with the American Heart Association that will give you a little bit more background on the system and answer any questions you may have. Thank you. And we also have some handouts on the system as well for your convenience.
Thank you. Mr. Bell, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members and Senator Franzen. My name is Justin Bell with the American Heart Association. I'm the Government Relations Director for Minnesota. And I've been working with the Department of Health and stakeholders from across the state for the last 5 years in designing a Minnesota-specific acute stroke care system. Stroke is a time-critical condition, like Senator Franzen mentioned. That means that the biggest factor in determining patient outcomes is how quickly that patient gets appropriate treatment. With most strokes, there's a specific window of time in which proper treatment can occur. Inside of that window, and outcomes are very good. Outside of that window, and outcomes plummet. So the purpose of the system is to speed up every little step along the way to make sure that that patient gets the treatment inside of that window of time. Time matters. Minutes can be the difference between going back to work after your event or being disabled for life. It can mean going home from the hospital or going to a long-term care facility. With minutes, it can be the difference between life and death when it comes to stroke. So the national consensus is to take a systems-based approach to look at all of the little steps along the way to analyze where we can speed the process up and get people the treatment quicker. Like Senator Franzen said, the Minnesota Stroke System is a statewide network of ambulance services and acute care hospitals that meet national standards for treatment of acute stroke. This has been developed over the course of 5 years with more than 100 participants in a statewide committee from all areas of the state and from all parts of the process. In 2014, let me take just a quick step back. Before we started implementing the system, we had less than 20, 16 or 17 nationally accredited hospitals that could treat stroke, and we knew exactly what capacity they had. Those were almost all located in the metro, also in Duluth and Rochester. But we knew that if we really wanted to speed this up and serve the entire state, we had to include our rural critical care hospitals. The small community hospitals that people are used to going to and that are in the communities needed to be a part of this system. That was the first part of rolling out the stroke system, is the Department of Health started designating acute stroke-capable hospitals. Our goal was by the end of last year to have 25 hospitals designated across the state, so sort of have a bigger spread of care facilities. We have 67 and even more applications in the queue for designated status. The Department of Health plays the coordinator role in the system, and that means that it has activities like providing technical assistance to help hospitals meet stroke-ready hospital designation criteria, providing tools and resources to hospitals and ambulance services to develop their stroke programs and their protocols, developing an online tool used for submitting applications, coordinating the review of designation applications by an external review committee, facilitating the statewide advisory committee, which monitors the system. Also, that's the committee that helped advise and design the system as it went along, and then, of course, running the stroke registry program. Up to this point, we've been designing and implementing the stroke system under the auspices of the federal CDC grant, the Coverdell Stroke Registry grant. That grant may or may not continue as time goes on. In the next funding round, there's even fewer states getting that funding. This appropriation would ensure that the basic functions of the system can continue in Minnesota, and we won't take a step back in the future. Minnesota's used this federal money very wisely and efficiently to design a Minnesota-specific system to have better stroke outcomes for anywhere in the state. This has a higher implication for rural Minnesota. Roughly one-third of all strokes happen in rural areas, and they have significant geographic issues, staffing issues, they can have weather issues. And this system assures that all Minnesotans receive top-quality stroke care regardless of where they live in Minnesota. And if it's all right with you, Mr. Chair, I'd like to hand it over to Joan Soames from the Emergency Nurses Association, who's been a critical partner in developing and implementing the stroke system.
Okay, Ms. Soames, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Joni Soames. I'm a registered nurse. I've been a registered nurse that worked in an emergency room for 40 years. I also work as an educator for EMS, the pre-hospital people, and I have helped roll out the system. And maybe I'm here more to tell you what it was like when I first started out. If someone had a stroke, they would come into the hospital, be brought into the hospital, and that was it. Whatever we saw is what happened, and basically, as Justin said, ended up in long-term care or maybe died as a result of the stroke. And in the last few years, what we've seen happen with the institution of the different medications is that we know that if someone is brought to us having a stroke, if they get to us in time, we can go ahead and treat them successfully enough that they go from looking at me with a panicked look in their face because they can't tell me what's wrong. They can't talk. They can't move. But they know that they want to tell me that something's bad, and I can, if I have enough time, I can get them that medication or I can get them to the treatment that they need. And the reason the stroke system is so important is that we need to have everyone able to get that help as fast as they can. The time is critical. EMS people recognizing that the patient is having a stroke, giving a heads up to their local hospital who can then get ready to accept that patient, and that hospital getting ready with their scanner so they can scan the patient, start the treatment right away, either keep them in their hospital or transfer them to a bigger city hospital. But I've seen what happens when you can treat them quickly. I've watched patients totally turn around and be able to walk out of the hospital when they came in, unable to talk to us whatsoever. On the list, it says I'm with the Minnesota Emergency Nurses Association. That is true. That's part of one of the hats that I wear. I also wear the National Emergency Nurses Association membership position. And I can tell you, as I'm out walking around this whole United States, people are really impressed by what we have in Minnesota. And if we don't continue to support our stroke system, we're going to find that our patients are not going to be able to get the care that they need as quickly as they do. They need our EMS people need the education, our nurses need the education, and our emergency departments need that education. And that's part of what is included in this bill. So I ask you to go ahead and support it. And if you've got any questions on stroke care, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Senator Franzen, did you have one more testifier?
I did, but I don't see her in the room.
Okay.
So I imagine she was not able to make it, but certainly supports the bill as one of my constituents.
Sure. Okay. I was just reading it and trying to understand exactly how it would be used. This would go into the forecast. It would just be there ongoing, it looks like, and it's to cover the costs of a disappearing CDC federal grant. It is what it appears to me. And there looks to be some items that might be time-limited in nature. I mean, I think providing the technical assistance, you know, hopefully soon we have the system in place and maybe we don't need the technical assistance to keep building it. I'm just thinking through this is what I see, and so maybe you can have a response to that. Develop online tools. You know, at some point, I would hope those would be developed and the costs could come into line with that. Possibly the coordinate review and design of applications. You know, if we can get this system once built, I guess the question is there the need to have this ongoing, you know, forever? Is it front-loaded a little bit so that we can actually get to a stable place at some point?
Sure. Thanks, Mr. Chair, for that question. That might be a better question for Department of Health staff, but I know that the things that were listed in my testimony were things that they've done so far in the implementation with the grant money that's gone ahead. The $350,000 was looking at the basic functionality going on so that, I mean, there's certainly more things in the system that can be done, and we'll certainly be trying to get more of those federal dollars to do those. The $350,000 was really, that protects us from having to shut the system down should all of the federal dollars go away.
Is there someone from the Department of Health who can speak to this? Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Albert Tsai. I'm the director of the stroke program at the Minnesota Department of Health, and I've been involved in the development and implementation of the stroke system along with the Heart Association and many stakeholders around the state. And I think your assessment of it being more front-loaded is partially correct. There is a definite need for technical assistance. But as we go forward and hopefully we get more hospitals to be designated, right now we have 67 that are designated, and right now I think 10 more are queued up to be designated. So there's still another 40 or 50 hospitals that need assistance for that. So that's going to be an ongoing effort for probably another couple of years. The other phase in our system work is to work with EMS and pre-hospital care providers and making sure that they have up-to-date protocols. And that's a whole nother kettle of fish, but it really is a big task at hand. I can tell you that, as Ms. Soames mentioned here, education is a very big part of all of this. And with a lot of turnover in pre-hospital providers as well as hospital providers, we're going to need to continue to provide that education as we go forward. And two more things. As we go forward, we want to make sure that we evaluate the system and make sure that we're making an impact and we're using these dollars and these resources wisely. So we're going to need to continue to monitor and evaluate that system. And that's not just a one-time proposition. It's an ongoing activity. And the last thing I wanted to mention is right now we've really found that we've been very successful so far. The work that we've been doing has far exceeded our expectations, but there are still a lot of needs that exist. Our current assessment is that there are about one in four Minnesotans, the closest hospital to which they live is not yet designated. So that is an area, a gap that we want to close. And there are geographic regions in the state that are not within half an hour's driving time of a designated hospital. So we really need to ensure that all the hospitals in all parts of the state, all communities are what we'd call covered and close by to places where they can receive the best possible treatment that we can offer right now for strokes.
Okay. Senator Franzen?
Want to add, Mr. Chair, on that point, you know, there's also, like the testifiers have mentioned, some savings when you're considering avoiding having patients end up in long-term care if we're able to get them up and walking out the door when they come to the emergency room. So those savings are not necessarily in a fiscal note in front of us, but certainly $350,000 a year to make the system work for all of our state, I think, is a good investment. And if we can get some fiscal note on that end, we certainly can try to find some dollars that we can look at and see in terms of cost savings.
I should add, I have been a strong proponent of making sure that we have the stroke designation and the stroke system in place. I just have to do our job here. So, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm just doing my job, too, about on your sheet here it says Senator Franzen or perhaps Mr. Bell. The competitive federal funding was supposed to be announced the end of February. Have you heard of anything? Where is Mr. Bell? Perhaps the department can.
Mr. Tsai.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Oh, Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen. We did actually recently receive our announcement from CDC for the application, for the funding announcement, and that application is due April 27th. I can expand a little bit more about that if you like.
Please, Mr. Tsai.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, they've announced this funding announcement. Currently, there are 11 states that are funded by CDC, and they're reducing that number of states to be funded for this next round to 6. So that is a concern nationally as well as locally, but of course, we hope to put in a brilliant application and try to get those funds, but by no means is there a guarantee.
So when would you know if the application is due at the end of April, April 27th, I think you said? Mm-hmm. I think like May 17th is an important day for us. Will you know by then?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, typically, CDC will let us know by the middle of June. The next funding cycle will start June 30th.
Okay. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And hopefully, we are not penalized through this grant system because we are already starting to set up a system. Sometimes that happens to us in this state. But I do just want to make just a couple comments that Senator Franzen, you know, obviously I support this bill, and I agree that early treatment is very imperative. It's actually, I look at it as a prevention measure to cost savings, not only in our health care, but also saving lives. That's extremely important. But also with Senator Lori talking about, you know, building the system that's up, and I think something that's missing out of all of this information here is that the telemedicine, which we heard last night, and that is an important part, and I actually got to witness it at my local hospital, which is in this on this map. It's not even doesn't even have a designation, but they have set up telemedicine with the mothership, which is in Rochester, and because they don't have that many stroke situations coming through that hospital, they can't have a neurologist on full time, but they have the telemedicine set up to Rochester, to the Mayo system, and it's immediate care by the emergency room. And so I think this is a missing piece to this plan, is that we have to look at telemedicine. I'm hoping that we can pass as a body this Telemedicine Act, and that it really works well with this telestroke. So ongoing, I think we should take all that into mind, that this is a big white board again. I mean, how many other things are happening, moving at the same time that could adjust what you're trying to do here, Senator Franzen? More of a statement?
I was just going to ask, is that okay? Senator Benson, I know, had a question or a comment.
Mr. Chair and Senator Franzen, along the lines of what Senator Lori was talking about, we should have sort of gone through the shakedown cruise on this, so some of the implementation design, et cetera, should be done. I get a little concerned that the work grows to fill the FTEs provided, and we're not focused on sort of the lean final outcome that's essential. And so if we fund three FTEs at the Department of Health, this will just stay there forever, whether we need them or not. If one could do it, will we ever really have the conversation that one is enough? Because there will be additional, we will work on that last 10% until we're at 100%, almost regardless of cost and resources. And so I echo your concerns maybe a little more emphatically than you would, Mr. Chair, but I think we're seeing a trend of FTEs being put in place, and then the work will fill them as we go forward.
Mr. Chair,
Senator
Benson, I completely agree with you as well. And I think one of our functions as a committee is to evaluate this on a biennium basis or however we so choose, and maybe report back what has been done with the money, whether it's implementation or growing the program. It's certainly something that we should shine more light into and provide more transparency, and I completely agree with you.
So maybe, Dr. Tsai, maybe you could follow up with what the current budget for your function is, what you're maybe going to lose in federal funding, a breakdown of how you would utilize this $350,000 a year, maybe over the four years that we track in the budget, and that would maybe give us a sense of whether there was that ongoing need or what, help us evaluate it a little bit. That'd be helpful. Any other questions of members? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And perhaps let's, if we do receive the grant, how much is the grant worth from the federal grant?
Dr. Tsai?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, the cap of this next grant is $800,000.
For 1 year?
For 1 year. And then it would be renewed for a five-year period.
Let's make it a really great grant application.
So it would be renewed. It would be a five-year period, and as long as you met the terms, you would get that amount in each of the next 5 years.
Yes, that's correct.
All right. Any other questions of members? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 790? And that's all filled in. Yep. Seeing none, Senator Franzen moves Senate File 790 be recommended to pass and laid on the table for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Bill. On that motion, any final questions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Franzen.
Thank you, members. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Last on the agenda, we have Senate File 63, Senator Eakin. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members. The purpose of Senate File 63 is to provide reimbursement to licensed independent clinical social workers and also for licensed marriage and family therapists for consultation to primary care practitioners regarding mental health treatment of clientele within the interdisciplinary structure of quality care. Social workers and therapists provide an array of varying mental health services, and they have skill and training in assessing, treating, and preventing psychological, behavioral, emotional, social, and environmental problems affecting the consumers of mental health. Clinical social workers and licensed marriage and family therapists are pursuing reimbursement for consultation with primary care. I think it's important to note that currently, psychologists, psychiatrists, and advanced practice registered nurses can be reimbursed for consultation to primary care providers. So we're simply asking that they be treated the same, the clinical social workers and the therapists be treated the same as they are. Clinical social workers and licensed therapists have expertise in mental health diagnosis, health psychology, interdisciplinary planning and care, case management, and clinical treatment planning, all of which can be both very useful to primary care providers as well as necessary additions to treatment and medications. And the clinical social workers and the licensed therapists should be reimbursed for their services It really is, again, an issue of fairness, treating them the same. But most important, I think, is the fact that it's the best for the patients. We should be encouraging interdisciplinary cooperation in order to provide the best care for the patients, or at the very least, not discouraging such care, which I think we do when we don't reimburse these people for the services they provide. And with that, I do have Mr. Bill Straczynski here today to speak to the bill as well.
Mr. Straczynski, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Bill Straczynski, and I'm here today representing the Minnesota Society for Clinical Social Work. Mr. Chairman, members, Senator Eakin did a fantastic job describing what this bill does, and I have no further comments, actually. We just want to thank him for his authorship of this piece of legislation.
Excellent. There's one other testifier on the agenda here, Amanda Richards. Is that correct? Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Amanda Richards. I'm a licensed professional clinical counselor and a licensed alcohol and drug counselor. I am here representing the Minnesota Counseling Association. I would like to thank you, Senator Eakin, for considering the inclusion of licensed professional clinical counselors in Bill SF63. Since 2009, licensed professional clinical counselors have provided mental health services to Minnesotans, including assessment, diagnosis, and treatment. We are also knowledgeable about a range of mental health issues, including mild to severe anxiety, depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, and other psychopathologies. We are also defined in statute as mental health professionals comparable to advanced practice nurse practitioners, psychologists, licensed independent clinical social workers, and marriage and family therapists. We have similar training, education, requirements to LICSWs and LMFTs, and so we are asking to, respectfully, asking to be included in SF Bill 63. I think that covers it. So.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair.
Senator Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Richards, I agree with her that they should also be including professionals like licensed professional clinical counselors. Unfortunately, there's not a fiscal note that's been prepared for them at this time, but I think that eventually they should also be included. But at this time, we won't be able to do that. So
maybe this would be a good time to kind of say that, if, you know, for the committee, especially for authors who are bringing bills before us, our job is to look at the fiscal notes of a bill. And if you have an amendment, you know, I'm saying authors have to have a fiscal note drafted for their amendment. If you're coming forward and know that you have an amendment, the committee, in order to do our job, needs to understand the fiscal ramifications of that amendment. And so you need to work with council and fiscal staff to have that priced out so that we can do our job properly. Of course, amendments from the committee are proper, but if members of the committee also know something ahead of time that they'd like to include, please, in order for us to do our job, go out and get that priced out so that we can lay it on the table with a good conversation about it. I think that we have a valuable process here where we evaluate the cost of something, and when ideas that are known ahead of time come at the last minute and we don't have them priced out, we circumvent that ability to have the conversation, and it just doesn't help the process very much. So thank you for respecting that, Senator Eakin. I appreciate it a great deal. Any questions of members? Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Eakin, I don't remember the conversation we had about this in the policy committee, but there was some question about including marriage and family therapists because there was a differential in the training. Was that resolved, or am I remembering a different bill? Somebody can help me. Senator Eakin, did you have any conversations about differential in training between the two groups that are included in your bill?
And, Senator Eakin?
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, I do recall that conversation in the policy committee where we did add the licensed marriage and family therapists, and I would refer that question to Mr. Erdman, who does represent the therapists.
Mr. Erdman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Henry Erdman today on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Marriage and Family Therapists. Marriage and Family Therapists are master's levels trained and also plus 4,000 hours of supervised training after that, much similar to the other professions who are included within this bill.
Senator Sharon?
I just wanted to clarify that a differential between this license and the advanced practice nurse is the prescriptive authority. That is why the APRN was included initially, because of the shortage of access to prescribers. And so we wanted to include and expand access, especially in the rural area, to prescribers for medications. These other professionals do not have that. So it's not an equivalency in terms of background.
Any other questions of members? Anyone else in the audience wish to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 63? Seeing none, Senator Eakin, move Senate File 63. As amended, be recommended to pass and referred and laid on the table for possible inclusion in the HHS omnibus bill. On that motion, any further questions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Eakin. And
thank
with
you,
that,
Mr. Chair.
Just to give members a little heads up, next week we do have a hearing on Monday to hear the OLA report on managed care organizations. Administrative spending, and then Wednesday we are going to hear bills. You know, we're coming up on the policy deadlines. We're freeing up some space actually for policy committees to really get their work done, but I need members to understand that when we get back from break, we have a very short window to hear bills, and we will be having very full agendas, probably carrying on into the evening, and we'll have to be really on time and doing our work well in order to do our work well. With that, we stand adjourned. Thank you.